Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. The pandemic has shown a light on the capacity of meatpacking facilities in Wyoming, potentially propelling state and federal money towards the industry that's not been seen for a while.
I had asked or tried to see if there was any available assistance for people trying to start businesses like this in the state, and we just had not.
American politics are polarized, but one issue appears to be an exception.
This previously divisive issue is bringing people together.
And sorting fact from fiction is proving difficult as Albany County debates wind development.
Misinformation doesn't help us make good decisions, right?
Join us for those stories and a look at the Wyoming Cowgirls getting ready for the NCAA tournament. That's coming up next on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Even though Wyoming is twice as many cattle as people, the state does not have a robust meatpacking facility network. In fact, there are mostly only small custom facilities in the state, with only a few that can send products across state lines. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska reports on how the pandemic has propelled those in charge to change this.
Back in 2019, Valerie Murray's business was doing really well.
We were able to send some of our beef over to a five-star restaurant, and the demand became huge. And we were shipping approximately about 20 head of primals, just the primal cuts, a month over to Taiwan.
Murray is the partner of Murray Farms in Powell. She's been in the business a long time, and even though she had a great buyer, she struggled to find a meatpacking facility in Wyoming that would be able to process her meat for her.
We're talking about on an average 42 head of beef needing to go to market, which capacity-wise in anywhere in Wyoming wasn't realistic. So we've been going to the commodity plants like your JBS and your Cargill for years and years and years because we had nowhere local to go.
And then the pandemic hit, and there was a backlog in those bigger facilities as workers got sick. And the smaller Wyoming plants weren't any help either.
And all of a sudden they said, you know, we can't get anything in until March, April, or May of next year. And this is, we're talking October, November of last year. So we became one of the many people that was on the waiting list.
Once the big national meat processing plants shut down, all kinds of producers flocked to regional facilities, but there wasn't enough processing capacity for the demand. One of those local facilities is Wyoming Legacy Meats.
We're booked up till almost a year in advance.
That's Frank Schmidt, the co-owner of Wyoming Legacy Meats. He headed into the pandemic with 50 head of cattle capacity per week, and as producers flocked to him, he wasn't able to handle the oversupply. Schmidt, like Murray, was aware before the pandemic that Wyoming didn't have medium to large meatpacking facilities and almost no USDA certified ones. That allows meat to be sold across state lines.
One of the reasons that we started the Wyoming Legacy Meats was because I was amazed that an agricultural state like Wyoming didn't have an ability to process beef and ship it across state lines.
Since 2016, when Schmidt bought his plant, he always wanted to expand, but he was starting to run out of money.
I had asked or tried to see if there was any available assistance for people trying to start businesses like this in the state, and we just had not.
But as state officials watched what was happening, they became concerned. So the state responded with the Meat Processing Expansion Program. That took federal CARES Act funds and matched plants' expenses up to $500,000 to help expand, upgrade, or provide social distancing at meat processing plants. The grant actually increased the number of USDA-certified facilities in the state, and for Schmidt, it doubled his production.
We were able to buy several machines that we have in our facility right now that are functional.
Plus, the Cody Economic Development Organization received a $2.2 million grant from the U.S. Economic Development Administration to create a new meat packing facility that should be able to process up to 300 head per week. That plant will be run by Wyoming Legacy Meats.
But that's still a very small plant, but it's big enough to supply beef for, you know, a region of all Northwest Wyoming and Southern Montana. I mean, we could cover a large area with that.
For Wyoming Business Council's agribusiness director, Jill Turgemba, the pandemic shone a light on the weakness of the food supply chain in the state.
That kind of sped up the interim talk on meat processing. And I think that's why you're seeing more bills hit the legislature this spring. As we look at, you know, the big picture of meat processing.
There are two bills going through the legislature right now. One would create a meat packing program to help expand facilities throughout the state, and House Bill 54, which tells the Wyoming Business Council to look for ways to support producers and processors.
Regardless of if 54 passes or not, it will be a priority at the Business Council.
Both Schmidt and Murray are cautiously optimistic that the pandemic has helped push the momentum forward for creating a cohesive and robust meatpacking network in the state. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kadalska at the Center of the West in Cody.
These days, whether you're a lawmaker or a citizen, you may be having trouble agreeing on just about anything with someone on the other end of the political spectrum. But one issue has seen some bipartisanship in our region. Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen explains.
Wyoming is one of 28 states that still has the death penalty. And the last time someone was executed was in 1992.
But what I come away with remembering about that,
that's Republican Senator Cale Case speaking on the Wyoming Senate floor,
is when that execution actually occurred, I felt it. And people all over Wyoming felt it because we were part of it.
Case was speaking this month in favor of a bill to repeal the death penalty in Wyoming. It went on to fail by just 8 votes. About a decade ago, that kind of margin in this conservative legislature was unimaginable.
I've been around now for, I'm going on my 11th year. I brought an anti-death penalty bill my very first year.
That's Wyoming's House Minority Floor Leader, Kathy Connolly. It was in 2010 when the Democrat introduced her first anti-death penalty bill.
It was a pretty partisan issue. It was, and not even all Democrats believed in the abolition of the death penalty.
Needless to say, her legislation didn't get anywhere that year. This go-around, 12 Republicans sponsored a bill alongside Connolly and one other Democrat. And more conservatives taking on the issue of capital punishment isn't unique to Wyoming.
There's been a sea change in death penalty attitudes in the United States.
That's Robert Dunham with the nonpartisan research group Death Penalty Information Center.
So we've seen this shift among people whose philosophy is pro-life. We've seen a shift among people whose philosophy is limited government, and they see the extension of government to the point of taking somebody's life as the ultimate exercise of big government.
While about 3/4 of Republicans say the death penalty is applied fairly, repeal bills sponsored by GOP lawmakers are becoming more common. Plus, more people on the left have joined the cause. And Dunham says it makes for some interesting timing.
With an unparalleled level of polarization in American politics, this previously divisive issue is bringing people together.
Sabrina King is with the American Civil Liberties Union of Wyoming, one of many groups that has been pushing for the repeal for several years now.
It is interesting to see, even within our own coalition, the different reasons that people are involved. And it does run the gamut.
It basically comes down to two different arguments: the moral cost and the fiscal cost of state-authorized execution. Death penalty cases are significantly more expensive for a number of reasons, including longer trials, subsequent appeals, and for high-profile cases, jury sequestration.
The death penalty is far more expensive than any other sentence or component of the criminal justice system.
That's Kylie Taylor with the group Conservatives Concerned About the Death Penalty.
As conservative Republicans, we believe in fiscal responsibility, and especially right now with the way that our economy is in Wyoming.
The state is facing an economic crisis. Even for its boom and bust history, it's a significant downturn. Still, that wasn't enough to get the bill passed this time, and the coalition is already gearing up to try again next session. Plus, Sabrina King with the ACLU says the bridge the coalition has built could take them beyond this one particular issue.
I do think the kind of relationships that get built when you do this work lend themselves to conversations about harder things.
For Representative Kathy Connolly, she says the conservative support for repeal is a long time coming. And as far as reaching across the aisle goes,
it's why I'm here, and it's why I do the job that I do in a body that is a kind of a supermajority. I believe in the system. I believe that we are as a state, as a bipartisan body, that we can come up with solutions. And the only way we do that is by working together.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Maggie Mullen.
When we come back, we will visit with the president of the Wyoming Education Association about possible budget cuts. This is Open Spaces.
This time on the Modern West, we find out whether my parents move away from their small town, shrinking it even more.
I don't have a big interest in moving there. You know, personally, to have things to do, to get up in the morning and go, okay, I'm going to fill in the blank. Well, it is a blank.
It's the final chapter of our ghost towning series. Find the Modern West under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org, sponsored by Sheridan Travel and Tourism.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. Over the last couple of weeks, the Wyoming House and Senate have been making changes to the funding model that funds schools in the state. Most of the focus has been on cuts, with the Senate trimming over $100 million and the House somewhere around $60 million. The funding model provides money that schools say they need to operate and is court mandated. To change the model, there needs to be evidence that less money is needed. Grady Hutcherson is the president of the Wyoming Education Association. I asked him if the legislature is doing things legally.
You know, that's an important question because we know that our elected officials have to uphold the Wyoming Constitution and making these decisions related to educational funding. And, you know, we were excited initially with the fact that House Bill 173 was at least looking at, you know, a three-step approach. So there was the component with the reductions, of course, but then also an attempt to divert revenue flows and to increase a proposed tax. But as you mentioned, after some of those amendments, it's now leaning towards just being, again, problematic because those are arbitrary cuts, which are not evidence-based.
How would you like to, in English, explain to the listeners what cost-based means? It's a term we'll use a lot in coming weeks. What exactly are you talking about?
So that's so important for all of us to try to be able to understand. So in my interpretation in English, cost-based means that the funding is based on what the actual cost is for the different parts or components in the model for the school district.
And those are the kinds of things that, if they do adjust, is the appropriate way to either raise money for the funding model or, in this case, reduce it, correct?
That is correct.
But at the end of the day, they get a block grant, and that's come up in the Senate quite a bit. Do you think people are overstating how the block grant works? I'm curious what you've heard that concerns you out there.
Block grant is another component that I think causes some confusion. So, the districts receive, in essence, all of that money in a lump sum. And then with local control, they're able to determine how they need to spend that money in order to meet the needs of the students within their own district. So Senate File 143, for example, moves some of the funding components outside of the model, which takes away that local control. But ultimately, when I think about these cuts that are being proposed, I've spent the past 24 years in the classroom teaching second grade in Torrington, and I know firsthand that these devastating and arbitrary cuts will lead to a loss of jobs in school districts, and those people will then be forced out of their communities. It also will negatively impact students because ultimately it will increase the class size. So all of those issues are very concerning and problematic.
One of the things that the Senate believes that it did is have an amendment in there that would protect teachers, give them actually more pay, and reduce money out of administration. Senator Wasserberger, who's been involved with education most of his career, indicated that he thought that was silly, that there's definitely going to be cuts and it will affect the classroom. Could you explain if he's right or not and your thoughts on that?
I do wholeheartedly believe that he is correct, because ultimately, I think the argument the Senate was trying to make is that they were reducing or changing funds to match what is actually happening in the district. But the problem with that is that because of underfunding previously, districts within that block grant we were talking about have to shift money from one part to the other. And there's just not enough. You know, when we think about a school district's budget, potentially 80% of that is spent on employees. So even though the teacher salary was increased, it's still not to the actual rate that districts are paying. And that's why, in fact, we will have to lose jobs to make up for that loss.
Can I ask you, and I hate to put you on the spot, but at the same time, I want to put you on the spot on this. We hear an awful lot about school administration salaries. I have to tell you, Grady, that for the last 6 or 7 years when I've interviewed people about school funding, it's something they always point to. Is that something that needs to get reined in? And as somebody who represents teachers, is this an important discussion that needs to take place in districts?
You know, I appreciate that question. I think we can look at all of those different components. But it is important, I think, to keep in mind that the administrative salaries within the model is actually a very small percentage of the overall spending. And ultimately, you know, it has to be a local school board who is determining what an appropriate salary is for those administrative positions so that they can attract candidates to those positions and then keep qualified people in those positions. So a professional and competitive salary is very important, not just for teachers and all education employees, but also for administration.
How irritated do you get when you hear people say we're not getting bang for our buck?
It almost is bad enough that it makes the hair on the back of my neck stand up, unfortunately. You know, we are very critical at times, and we're often reluctant to celebrate our successes. But we do, in fact, know that Wyoming has worked very hard over the past 10 years plus to actually become focused on excellence in the education that we provide to our students. And we've even should be celebrating more the fact that Wyoming is recognized as being the best in the West when it comes to education.
Third in the country, isn't it, on NAEP scores, something like that?
I think it might be six, somewhere along there, yeah.
But that's pretty good, right? Sixth in the country for something along those lines. And so when you hear that misinformation, and it probably trickles down to folks at home, how do you combat that?
I think it all boils down to helping and informing people to understand what the reality is, and the fact that, you know, we can look at all types of different data and information to see how our students are doing, whether it's graduation rates or academic performance. But the other part of the conversation has to be a realization that providing education to every student in Wyoming, particularly in our very rural and smallest of the small schools, is in fact very expensive.
Grady, maybe one last thing for you. What you represent the teachers in the state. What's been the feedback you're getting, and how are people viewing all of this?
Teachers, as well as the educational support professionals, are very concerned because, you know, there's been ongoing discussion about these types of cuts for well over the past year. I also know that our teachers that are beginning their profession are concerned because they don't know if they can rely and count on being able to continue and have a job in Wyoming.
Randy Hutcherson, again, is the president of the Wyoming Education Association. We'll be chatting with you, I'm sure, later in the session. Thank you so much for making time.
Sounds great. Thank you so much, Bob.
Changing gears. COVID-19 vaccinations in the state have been proceeding at different rates in every county. Albany County, for instance, is currently in Group 1C, which includes journalists. Wyoming Public Radio's Ivy Engel takes us to her first vaccine appointment.
Getting everyone vaccinated is hugely important to turn a corner in this pandemic. So I booked my appointment for a windy Friday morning.
Off to get the first shot.
The vaccination clinic I went to was in the old National Guard Armory near the University of Wyoming campus.
There's no signs or anything. But there's never any cars in this lot, and it's packed, so this has got to be it.
The building had arrows on the floor that urged people to stay 6 feet apart all the way until I reached the main room, which is the old gym.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm good, you?
Good, do you have an appointment?
Yes.
Awesome. Once one of these stations opens up, we'll get you going.
Yeah, not a big deal.
Inside the gym are rows of carefully spaced seats. When I get there, it's maybe about half full.
Hello. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. And I didn't catch your last name.
Engel, E-N-G-E-L.
Okay. And do you have an insurance card on you?
Yes.
Grab that from you.
Okay.
This is your vaccination record card.
Cool.
Hold on to that. They'll need it when you get your shot.
Okay.
Make sure that you bring it back for your second appointment.
Mm-hmm.
The date of the second appointment is on the back of the card there.
Look at that.
There is a survey available from the CDC. If you just scan that QR code.
Okay.
Thanks a lot. Yeah.
As I head to my assigned seat, designated by a volunteer in a bright orange vest standing next to it, the gym is echoing happy chatter as people interact with those giving them their vaccines. The vaccine administrators have tiny little desks they push from person to person. And after just a few minutes, my nurse is rolling hers toward me.
No.
She's working alone while others are working in teams.
Ivy, do I have your consent to give you a vaccine today?
Yep.
I don't think you're going to get the Pfizer vaccine today. I got the Moderna one, and these I got. And is this your first dose?
Yes. Can I actually, can I choose an arm?
Yeah.
Okay. I tend to sleep on my left side,
okay.
So I think it's probably best to not have it on the same side I sleep on.
And it's a good thing I chose to get my shot in the other arm. I felt like I'd been punched in the shoulder for about 3 days after.
It's funny, I hardly felt it go in, but I could feel when you were pushing the plunger.
Yeah.
Weird.
So we'll have you hang out for about 15 minutes.
Okay.
If you're feeling fine, you can go.
Of course, I managed to leave my vaccination card at my seat and have to be chased down to get a hold of it.
Is this yours?
Oh, thank you.
Yep.
I don't know how I managed to forget it. It's something I'll likely hold on to for forever. A memento of a weird and emotional year that's slowly drawing to a close. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Ivy Engel.
When we come back, we will sort through the fact and fiction surrounding wind energy. This is Open Spaces.
In part one of the new limited series, Carbon Valley, Wyoming searches for a way to stop the decline of coal. Under Governor Matt Mead, the answer became carbon capture, a technology that aims to store or use the emissions.
If you can solve that, you not only help the coal industry, but you may be able to create industries out of that in our own backyard where coal is so plentiful.
To do that, Mead had to do something big. Listen now to part one of Carbon Valley. Find it under the podcast tab at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Albany County is deep in a debate about the possibility of wind development within its borders. Wyoming Public Radio's Jeff Victor reports that finding facts about the issue can be difficult.
As energy companies look to build more wind farms in southeast Wyoming, the issue of wind development has bitterly divided residents of Albany County. You can characterize the two camps broadly as being either for wind development or against it. But wading into the fight, it's easy to get quickly overwhelmed with the diversity of opinions and the sheer amount of statistics, numbers, and claims being tossed about. During a public comment period at a county commission meeting, you might hear someone give the wrong statistic.
In practice, turbines extract only 39% of a wind's power.
But 15 minutes later, a scientist corrects the record.
The theoretical limit on extracting kinetic energy from wind is 59%. It's called Bett's Law.
But not all claims are as neatly refuted as this. At that meeting alone, 40 people commented on the issue of wind. Additionally, websites, mailers, and opinion pieces are also circulating through the community, making bold claims about the harms or benefits of wind energy. To get my head around the issue, I spoke with an expert about some of these claims. Jonathan Naughton leads the University of Wyoming's Wind Energy Research Center. He says both sides of the debate have spread misinformation, but that the majority, at this point, is coming from those speaking against wind development. Naughton says a turbine's efficiency is one common point of confusion or misrepresentation. A wind turbine takes the power available in the wind and transforms it into electrical power, but it's not perfectly efficient.
What people say is, you know, you always like to have efficiencies near 100%, right? But in order to get all that energy out of the wind, you'd have to actually bring the wind to a stop to recover all that kinetic energy. And that's not possible, right? If you brought it to a stop, you'd have no energy flowing through the turbine.
The theoretical limit to that efficiency sits at about 60%. Currently, a lot of wind turbines can do 50%, which experts say is more than enough to make them economically feasible. But money isn't everything, and many critics of wind development in Albany County point to the potential environmental impacts of the turbines themselves. For one, it currently takes non-renewable energy resources, like coal, to build a turbine.
So wind turbines do require non-renewable energy just like everything else we manufacture today, right? That's the way our electric grid is powered.
Naughton says that will change if renewables like wind and solar start to provide more of the grid's power. But even now, the renewable power produced by a turbine far outweighs the non-renewable power it took to make that turbine.
You'll see people say that, you know, wind turbines never produce more power than it took to build them, and that's patently false. Depending on the turbine model, it recovers all the energy it uses in somewhere between 5 and 8 months, as it's running. So if we use 6 months as the return time, then in 20 years, it's going to produce 40 times the amount of power that it took to make.
Another claim is that wind turbines kill birds. A lot of birds. Somewhere in the ballpark of 600,000 a year. Naughton says this claim is true, but he adds that domestic cats kill at least 2,000 birds for every one killed by turbines. And climate change, one of the main justifications for wind development, poses a substantial threat to birds as well.
Also, cell towers do a number on birds, skyscrapers, buildings, automobiles, all kill far more birds than wind turbines. And that's not to justify, it's just to put it in perspective.
These are complex and nuanced issues, and it can get messy when people have to explain their positions or what they've learned through their own amateur research during a live 3-minute public comment. But that's often where these debates play out. Albany County Commission Chair Pete Gosar says public comment is important for good decision-making. The problem is sorting fact from fiction, and people can use their public comment to knowingly or unknowingly spread false information. Gosar says that puts a lot of pressure on elected officials to ask their own questions.
Where did you get that information? Is that a peer-reviewed piece of information, or let's kind of discuss that, because I think it does really matter. Not all information is equal.
Gosar says it's important to read up on topics of debate in the community, to do the research. But research isn't as easy as it sounds, especially on a divisive topic like wind development. So people come to public meetings, not just with their own opinions, but with their own set of facts.
You can be so inundated with information that may or may not be accurate that it's almost the same as not having access to any information. I don't know exactly how to wrestle with that, and maybe somebody can give me a lot of comment on how to do that, because I really think it's important.
Back at the Wind Research Center, Naughton doesn't have any easy answers either. He agrees that the internet is full of conflicting, motivated sources of information, but
misinformation doesn't help us make good decisions, right? The decision can go one way or the other, but we want to base it on good information.
It might be difficult to find that online, where wind energy companies tout their own benefits and fossil fuel magnates quietly fund outlets like PragerU to tout the benefits of carbon dioxide. Albany County just received an application for a 26,000-acre wind farm, and it will be subject to the current regulations. But opponents of the wind farm continue to push for more restrictive regulations. For Wyoming Public Radio, this is Jeff Victor.
Communicating science is important, especially when it saves lives, like in the COVID-19 pandemic. But it's difficult to do when words mean different things to scientists and the public. Wyoming Public Radio's Ashley Piccone explains why word choice matters for scientists and the people listening to them.
The director of the Wyoming Science Communication Initiative, Bethann Garaman-Merkel, says there are a lot of things researchers can do to communicate better with the public. The first is recognizing that there's a problem.
Academic English, and especially in science, is a prestige dialect. Like, it's a different language in a lot of ways. But we don't know that language because we're smarter. We know that language because we've learned it and we've spent a lot of time around it.
For Garaman-Merkel, it's important to be aware that the public can perceive scientific vocabulary differently than researchers. She says a great example is the mule deer migration research done at the University of Wyoming. That research involves collecting a lot of data.
They get multiple GPS location points per day, per animal, and those animals might wear those collars for multiple years. So we're talking thousands, or even sometimes hundreds of thousands and millions of data points.
She says those GPS locations can be interrupted by clouds or canyon walls, just like we lose our cell phone service while driving through the state.
There will be locations that are in the data set that aren't accurate because the technology to triangulate that animal's location from the collar and the satellites it communicates with has been interrupted.
Because of that, researchers have to clean their data. That means they filter out the bad points. But often, scientists call that process something else, data manipulation. And the word manipulation is a problem.
Because in common culture, we think of manipulation as a very negative thing, as very close to being lied to. We have accidentally, as the scientists, set ourselves up to be not just not very credible, but like a used car salesman kind of stereotype.
UW science communicator Anna Nella Smith says data manipulation is just one example of words meaning different things to scientists and the public. She says another example is the word theory.
For someone in the sciences, a theory is really like our best current understanding of something. But to most people, a theory is just a guess or a speculation or conjecture. And so that common definition actually translates more closely to a scientific hypothesis.
She says the word theory is used a lot, but not always in the right way.
One of my pet peeves is when novels or movies portray scientists talking about having theories about things when they're really talking about hypothesis. It's always like a giveaway. It's like, yeah, no, scientists wouldn't say that.
Smith says it's important to recognize when words have double meanings.
When we overlook these different meanings that can exist even within specific single words, we're kind of inviting more opportunities for misunderstanding or mistrust.
But she says more scientists and educators are becoming aware of this problem.
I think that being more thoughtful about word choice makes us consider our audience more carefully, and that can help one, not reinforce these common misunderstandings, but also just forces us to think more about our audience.
For Garaman-Merkel, it's essential to communicate with people from all different backgrounds. She says sharing science is not the same thing as dumbing it down. It's about connecting with the public to see what really matters.
In order to connect meaningfully with people and potentially help them access science information in ways that they might use, we have to start with those people, their values, and what they need.
Garaman-Merkel and Smith agree that word choice is important for building trust and confidence in science and scientists. And with the current controversy over mask wearing and COVID-19 vaccines, that's essential. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Ashley Piccone.
More than 530,000 Americans have died due to COVID-19. and that includes close to 700 Wyomingites. In our series to honor their lives, Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler spoke with Lacey Peterson, the granddaughter of longtime Sundance resident Marlene Cooper. Cooper died from the coronavirus in November of 2020. Peterson starts by remembering her 86-year-old grandmother's early years in Sundance.
She pretty much lived there her whole life. She was born in Nebraska, but her family moved to a ranch outside of Sundance when she was very, very young. So she lived her whole life in Kirk County, pretty much. You know, whenever I think of Devil's Tower, I think of my grandma because she was always just like in that area. She graduated from Sundance High School. She worked at Tri-County Electric there. I think it's called Powder River now, but she was like an office manager there. I think she'd walk to work every day, like in high heels. My grandma was very beautiful. I think of the marvelous Mrs. Maisel, and like, that's what the pictures that I see of her, that's what she looked like. Then she always had really beautiful nails, and like, she had a Black Hills gold ring for every single finger, and she could wear high heels and red lipstick until her 80s. But she was a cowgirl at heart. Like, she loved cowboy boots, she loved cowboy hats, and she had like fringe jackets. And I remember my mom sharing a picture of her when she was in high school, and she had like a fringe jacket, and she had one of those until the day she died. I would describe my grandma as just like a youthful spirit. She laughed all the time, and she had a wonderful laugh. I will always remember her laugh. She loved to play games, and we always were playing games with her, card games and dice games, and we would always have like a family game of hearts or spades during the holidays. Even in her late 70s, she could beat me at cribbage. She had this little tiny camper, and it was the cutest little camper that she could pull with her like baby blue Thunderbird car. And like, she could pull it all the way to Sand Creek, and that's where she would stay. And we used to go out there, and they would go camping every year for like a week or a couple weeks, and we would always go out there with her. One story that people would always talk about is she had a really good friend. It was her neighbor in Sundance. They were really good friends. They like were on inner tubes, and I guess it took them a really long time. They were like in their 50s, but they floated in their inner tubes all the way to Beulah from like their campsite. And there were some cocktails at the end of that ride. There was the Beulah bar. So that was like a great story that I heard about. She retired from that job, and she had a life partner. His name was Jim, and she lived with him in Carlisle. They ran the Carlisle store together until, you know, things happened. Jim ended up passing away, though, and then she continued to live by Devil's Tower in the Carlisle area until she really needed to go into long-term care. You know, I think that's for some people, that transition's really hard into long-term care. I think it was hard for her initially, but I really respect the long-term care center in Sundance. They do a really great job. I think they have people that really care about their residents there. She was able to reconnect with some of the people that she knew growing up and in high school that were in there. She liked engaging with the staff. They had lots of little pranks they used to do on each other. My mom used to visit her probably a couple times or every other day. She was up there a lot at the long-term care center. She couldn't go visit her anymore. So I think that lack of visitation from people and was really significant. It was really hard on her. I think it probably is for a lot of people in those centers. I think my mom was able to go outside, and my grandma got to see her, but they couldn't, you know, be in the same room together. We Zoomed with her a couple times during the pandemic too, but It was hard on her. She tested positive on a Wednesday, and she passed away 6 days later. She died 3 days shy of her birthday. I think that this death is just, it's definitely a different kind of death. So, you know, we haven't been able to get together as a family and do some of the rituals that you do after somebody dies. I haven't been able to give my mom a hug. I haven't seen her in over a year. We haven't been able to eat casseroles or, you know, have a celebration of her life. So that's been really hard. It's been hard in the grieving process. You kind of get stuck. You're not able to really process it with the people that you love who knew her.
Up next, a conversation with the author of a series of fiction books, and the Wyoming Cowgirls are heading to the NCAA tournament. This is Open Spaces.
This time on Human Nature, Wynn thought he had to pass for straight, even in his beloved outdoors. But then a special pair of boots came into his life.
Photos are getting taken and things got posted to the internet. And then I came home to my house being egged.
These boots were made for hiking. I'm Erin Jones. Find Human Nature under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. Originally published online in 2004, The Diary of a Wimpy Kid is a series of fiction books that share the story of Greg Heffney and his journal entries as he navigates middle school. When it was published into a print series in 2006, it became an instant bestseller across the world. Now author Jeff Kinney is trying something new. His latest book, called Rolly Jefferson's Awesome Friendly Spooky Stories, pivots to zombies, vampires, and ghosts. Kinney will hold a drive-through book tour with a stop in Rock Springs Saturday. Wyoming Public Radio's Nina Rao spoke with the author.
I am a regular guy who got really lucky and got published. I had this idea for Diary of a Wimpy Kid, which is basically a journal, a kid's journal interspersed with cartoon drawings. I worked on it for a long time, 8 years. When it was published, I thought that it would, you know, suffer the fate of most books, which was appear on bookshelves for a little while and then to vanish. And it stuck around. It struck a nerve early on. So the books have done really well. And I think I'm about 14 years into this. So it's very exciting.
So what inspired the idea specifically for the Diary of a Wimpy Kid?
Yeah, it was my own journal. So when I was in my 20s, I started keeping a journal. What really inspired it was the normal events that happened in my life. I grew up in the United States in a middle-class family situation. And, you know, lots of funny things happen along the way in your life. And so I tried to record everything, write everything down that I could remember. And that's why it took so long for me to get my first draft out, was because I spent a lot of time just trying to gather material. And once I thought I had enough, that's when I started writing. The journals, if you saw them and opened them up, you'd say, oh, this is just Diary of a Wimpy Kid. Write a little bit and then draw a little bit and then keep going. And when I looked at that format, I said, you know what, this might actually work. And I'd never seen at that point a book like that, where there was kind of handwritten text and then cartoon drawings that had a DNA in newspaper comics. You know, most books that are illustrated books have illustrations that are sort of descriptive of what's happening in the text. My books are a little bit different because the cartoon drawings supplement the text, or they kind of add to the story or carry the story forward. So that's why they're a little bit different from regular illustrated chapter books.
So tell us what this new book is about.
The new book is a collection of short stories. It is about, and the stories are all over the place. There are stories about zombie invasions and vampires and werewolves and kind of, I cover all of the horror tropes that you would expect. But it's been really interesting, actually, as I've written these stories, I've kind of come to understand what the stories are really about and why they've been so enduring. So for example, you know, a werewolf story is about, you know, this unwanted transformation of your body, you know? And I'm like, oh, the werewolf story is really about puberty. You know, it's about the awkwardness of the change as well as the powers that come with the change. Just about every one of these horror tropes has some sort of really deep something at the center of it. You know, a zombie story is really the story of the fear of others, you know, and that's pretty elemental.
What made you want to use the supernatural element, adding vampires and zombies and werewolves to it?
Yeah, it's funny. It sort of happened accidentally and organically. It would usually start with a question, right? Like I would take something like the zombie story and I would say, okay, what usually happens in a zombie story? Well, the zombies try to get in and then the zombies get in and then they eat all the people and there's a few people left. That's just about every zombie story that's ever been told follows that pattern, right? And the zombies outnumber the regular people. And as I was writing that story, I said, okay, wouldn't it be funny if the people, rather than trying to keep the zombies out, they let the zombies in, right? And so then you end up with this kind of interesting story, which is about assimilation. And it's, you know, the zombies in this story, they come to live with the regular people, right? And so zombies and regular humans are living side by side in harmony, which was kind of a fun story to write. And I was like, you know, and then everything that comes with that, like all the, you know, what would happen if zombies and people live side by side? That's the question. And it turns into something a little bit deeper because it turns into a story about acceptance and assimilation.
You're coming to Wyoming.
Yeah, my first time ever. I've done, you know, two tours now that went up through the Northeast. And I think right now I'm one of the only touring authors, because most authors are doing virtual tours, which I fully support and understand. You know, I own a bookstore here and we do lots and lots of author visits that are virtual, but I really need to get out of here. And we wanted to do something big and live large. And so we're taking a trip that's going to take us from Colorado to Wyoming to Arizona and Nevada. We want to put a lot of distance under our wheels and see a lot of the country before we're done.
Why in person?
Why in person? Because I think that it's really important to connect with readers. It's important to show kids that there's an author behind the books that they read. And it's also important for kids to have something to do that's not canceled, something that's physical, something that's not on a screen. And so that's it's a combination of those things that's making us do it.
Jeff, thank you so much for talking to me today.
I really appreciate it.
Monday night, the Wyoming Cowgirls will make just their second appearance in the NCAA basketball tournament when they face UCLA in Texas. The Mountain West News Bureau's Stephanie Serrano has more.
The Wyoming Cowgirls just won their first ever Mountain West tournament championship. That's the Cowgirls basketball team during their post-game celebration in the locker room.
We won. We get to hang a banner in our gym like we did it.
Quinn Weideman has been a basketball player since elementary school. She remembers playing in the YMCA league as a 9 or a 10-year-old.
It wasn't like a tryout or anything. It was everyone play. There was a bunch of kids on the team.
And now she's a skilled collegiate player with the Cowgirls. Her team beat the University of Las Vegas in the first round, but they still have to face Boise State in the second round. That women's basketball program has dominated the Mountain West tournament for the last several years, winning 4 championships in a row.
I was very nervous. And then after we got past them, I was just kind of like, okay, like we got this. This is our time.
Then it was on to defeating Fresno State for the Mountain West title.
We might not have the best individual players, but the way that we play as a team, I think, just propelled us to make it to the championship game and then end up winning.
Wyoming played an intense defensive game, which forced Fresno State out of its comfort zone on offense. And that win means the Cowgirls now have an automatic spot in the single elimination national tournament, aka March Madness.
The big thing is that you know you get to put on that uniform one more time.
That's Heather Ezell, the Cowgirls associate head coach. Ezell played college ball and made it to the national tournament back in 2009. Her team didn't win back then, but they did make it to the top 8.
You get to walk out with your teammates and play the game you love one more time. You know, I still talk to teammates and that's what we talk about. Hey, those memories behind the scenes, you know, in the locker room, in the hotels, all that is just what it's all about.
And now she gets to do it all again, but this time as the coach.
You're so proud for these kids, everything they've done. You're so happy for them because they're the ones out there competing. And yeah, we put a game plan, but they are the ones that have to do it.
And it's been an especially tough year.
Dealing with COVID and the uncertainty of every game.
That's cowgirl Tommy Olson.
Getting tested in the morning 3 times a week and then making sure that everything was taken care of, going to practice, going home, going to school.
She says this moment is special because of all the sacrifices she, along with her teammates, made over the last year. The coaches knew this would be a tough season, so to help motivate the team, the staff surprised the players with personalized videos from their family members.
Hey, Tom, this is Mom.
This is Dad.
Hey, we just want to wish you and the rest of the Cowgirls the best of luck this season. You've been working since March.
That's Tommy's mom and dad. And get this, her mom also played basketball for Wyoming. Tommy says it's been exciting to compare her and her mom's basketball experiences.
Our game is similar. She was like always super active on defense. And so I feel like I kind of get that from her.
Gerald Mattinson is the team's head coach. He's been working with the women's basketball program for nearly a decade.
I think you see a league, a conference that values women's sports, women's basketball.
And he's noticing a change in player development.
I've seen a more competitive base in the women's side. You know, you're starting to see teams who, you know, we're allowed 15 scholarships. You're getting 15 good players that can compete for positions.
He says this is because girls have more options to play in different club leagues now and can refine their skills at a younger age. On Monday, the Cowgirls hosted a watch party to listen to the official national selection show on national TV to see who they're up against.
Welcome to the NCAA Women's Selection Special.
We've got UCLA taking on Wyoming.
Now Mattinson's team of competitive women will head to the national championship.
You know, we'll defend, we'll play really, really hard. But everything else, you know, breathe it all in, take it all in.
Mattinson says he really hopes his players will remember this moment. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Stephanie Serrano.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and individual segments are available on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. You can also get the podcast edition of the show through the usual venues, and Anna Rader is our web editor. Please support this Wyoming News program with your pledge via our website. We also invite you to follow the station on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.